this is the...
Wait a second. Start again.
This is the National Council of Jewish Women's Oral History with Mark Perlman, with Howard Braun and Ruth Saul as interviewers. It's March 21st, beautiful spring day.
Mm-hmm. March 20th.
Really?
Right.
Excuse me.
Mark, Professor Perlman, hi.
Good morning.
Howard. We're going to jump a little bit. I'd like to come to Pittsburgh.
Very good.
And I'd like to sort of lead you through a little bit of the infrastructure of Pittsburgh, and with whatever comments that come to mind that pertain to you the most. What do you think about the city in general, geographically, and the Jewish community? Will come next.
Well, I came to Pittsburgh from Baltimore. In Baltimore, I was on the faculty of Johns Hopkins, and being on the faculty of Johns Hopkins, certainly at that time, gave you a great local prestige. To say that you were a Hopkins faculty member meant that the clerks in the stores treated you with that tender, loving care, which I had never found before, and I might add, I have never seen since. We came to Pittsburgh in the autumn of 1963. I was brought here during the Litchfield era when the effort was made to upgrade the academic quality of the University of Pittsburgh. The era was had sort of climaxed in the period before I came. I had been hired a year previously, actually a year and a half previously, but I had a sabbatical in a Ford Foundation Fellowship in England and Europe in 1962 and 63. So when we got here in September of 1963, the era was in full flower, but if I had been able to look carefully, I would have seen that it was wilting around the edges. My first recollection of coming to Pittsburgh was that I was invited to the Duquesne Club the first week I was here, and I was invited to a dinner hosted by Adolph, A-D-O-L-P-H, Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, I think, who was one of the hangers-on in the Richard King Mellon family. The dinner was sponsored by the Mellon family in its efforts to help the Planned Parenthood Federation. When I came here, one of my colleagues, Edgar M. Hoover, Jr., and I had agreed to do a study for the Planned Parenthood Federation, and the thing was going to be outlined for us at this dinner in the Mellon Suite. Little did I know that this was surely the only time in my life I would ever be in the Mellon Suite, and one of the very few times in my life I was ever invited to dinner at the Duquesne Club. It has been downhill ever since. What was remarkable about the that dinner was not that there was a Jew in the Mellon Suite, but that there was a woman in the Mellon Suite. Apparently, the Duquesne Club generally did not have women in the private dining rooms. Strange to believe, but that's what we were told. Pittsburgh struck me as a very rich community. Far richer than any community I had ever lived in. I'm always much taken with the quality of the specialty shops, and the specialty shops in Pittsburgh at that time certainly approached Newbury Street in Boston or Madison Avenue in New York City. The Von Dohm shop at Kaufman's department store was a very high-priced place, and I reckoned that any place that could afford that sort of thing must have a lot of money to spend. As for the city, I anticipated that because Pittsburgh had a large Jewish community, that it would be sort of like Baltimore's Jewish community. You must recall that I was raised in Madison, Wisconsin, where the Jewish community was very marginal. I had lived in Honolulu, where the Jewish community was non-existent. I had taught at Cornell University, where the Jewish community was very small. In Baltimore, however, I had come on what I now realize was one of the most intellectual and one of the most cultured Jewish communities in the world. I had expected that Pittsburgh would be something like that. It was not. When we first came here, my brother-in-law had asked
Waxman.
Mordecai Waxman had written to Rabbi Halpern. I'm forgetting his first name.
Halpern.
At Tree of Life.
Halpern.
Halpern. I can't remember his first name. That's my problem.
Is it Julius?
No. I'll think of it. To invite us for the high holiday services. We went. It was at the time that the high holiday services were held for the first time in a very large sanctuary. It was before the sanctuary was air-conditioned, and I was quite impressed that the rabbis, speaking from the pulpit, said that it is uncomfortably hot. But I assure you, by next year, this place will be air-conditioned. And he was right. It was. I was taken with the rabbi's principal sermon because it was in defense of what are called Yom Tevin Jews, Jews who go to the synagogue only three times a year, namely the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Well, his argument was that this was something. Rather than attacking Jews for little observance, they should be honored for such observance as they maintained. Hilbert spoke well, but his sermon was not particularly intellectual. It was not particularly profound. On the other hand, I was well aware that on high holidays, rabbis often do give a special kind of sermon, speaking directly to the very large number of people who attend only during that period. Later I was to discover that the Tree of Life was on the left wing of the conservative movement, namely that it was the line between it and Reform Judaism was relatively thin. Reform Judaism had been moving to the right all of the time, and even the large synagogue in Pittsburgh, Rodolf Shom, was not that far away from having bar mitzvahs, and all of this was to come. We joined Tree of Life and remained there for a year, and then decided that we should join a another congregation, and we joined briefly Beth Shul. At that point, I agreed with some of my friends who had urged us to join the Young People's to become a member of the Young People's congregation. I particularly remember Joe Schwartz, who was an accountant in the Young People's Association, and he and I, in the best Jewish tradition, sat next to each other and glanced occasionally at the sitter, and even more, probably a little more care at the Humish, managed to survey all the problems of the community and the world every Saturday morning in private conversations. So my first reactions to Pittsburgh were that it was a very wealthy city, and that the Jewish congregations were not of the quality of the congregation Bethel that I had belonged to in Baltimore. No rabbi in the community had the theological style of Jacob Agus. Now, it is true that Solomon Frihoff had considerable intellectual style, but Frihoff's intellectual style was very much tailored to the mindset or the interests of the Rote Schoen congregation. And for that reason, I never found in Friedhoff's excellent sermons, their construction was magnificent, the intellectual punch which I had found in Jacob Agus's. By the way,
Agus, A-G-U-S?
A-G-U-S. Is Herman Halperin, who was the rabbi at Tree of Life. Later, we joined Beth Sholem, largely because I believe that Young People's Synagogue, for its own reasons, partly intellectual and partly economic, tended to run a low dues operation, mm-hmm. calling upon the other congregations in the community to furnish rabbanim when they were needed. And that struck me as essentially wrong. Institutions, whether you use them or not regularly, have to be maintained. And part of the having them around means that you have to pay for them. It's sort of very much like emergency departments at hospitals. Mm-hmm. You may not go to them very frequently, but when you want them, they have to be there. And if they are to be there, they have to be supported. So that was really my first reaction to Pittsburgh. On the university side, I was well aware that what Pittsburgh was trying to do, and I was very sympathetic with what Litchfield mm-hmm. Had in mind. Litchfield as an individual was something of a rather brilliant person who believed in the dictatorial system. A dictator, as I use the term, comes from the Roman concept. A dictator was a ruler who had plenary or full power. Now, whether a dictator was a tyrant or not was the issue. I thought that there were many elements in Litchfield's personality which made him rather tyrannical. But he was a very able man. And on one or two occasions when I did deal with him and disagreed with him rather strongly, I remember his turning to me and saying, well, nobody else in the room agrees with you. And my saying to him, well, nobody else in the room has a technical knowledge of the subject. I'm right and they're wrong. I thought it was rather interesting that this stopped Litchfield. On both occasions when this happened, and I remember them rather clearly, stopped me and said, why, what facts don't they know? And I proceeded to lay out these facts. And that stopped the decision-making process. I'm not sure that the decision-making process would have led to the decision that I anticipated was going to come up or not. One never knows. But it's certainly clear.
Let me jump. Mr. Pozvar.
Yes.
Would he listen to an objective statement of the issues? And did Litchfield seem to take account of the added fact?
Litchfield lost his power. Litchfield was losing his power at this point.
Mm.
And it may well be that all I did was to say to him, what you're proposing is a quick fix, and it won't work. Specifically, these problems dealt with questions of demography. Litchfield was concerned that Litchfield believed that demographic issues could necessarily reflected the views of gynecologists and obstetricians. And my reaction was that that is not the way that demographic policy is made. The group around Litchfield and the group around Mellon believed very strongly in encouraging fertility control. This was the days before Roe versus Wade, and abortion was not the issue. The issue was simply making birth control materials available to women. And there was the belief that if they were made available, that the fertility rates would immediately fall. And my view was that it was a much more complicated
problem. Yeah, but why was that a decisive issue for Litchfield?
Well, because the question was whether we should set up a population center, a population research center at the university. And his view was that we knew what the causes of the population crisis were, and all we had to do was to figure out the cures. And my view was that the big issue was not natality, although at the time people thought it was. Remember, this was 1963. The baby boom peaked in 1958. By 1960, the fertility rate had fallen rather dramatically. Now, most everybody believed that the fertility rate would start climbing again. There had been a recession in the early 1960s, and there was a general belief that the fertility rate went up with the business cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my view that we didn't know.
Would that have any relationship to economic controls in the city at that time?
Well, no. Litchfield's concern was largely based on national or world concerns. I don't want to get into this point, except to say that Hoover and I had approached the study of fertility and the role of fertility and the causes and the consequences of fertility as a rather simple problem when we started our study. But it was soon clear, and by the way, these discussions with Litchfield were in 65, not in 63.
Mm-hmm.
But it was soon clear to us, at least clear to me, that the division between causes and consequences was a very neat intellectual division, but it had to be studied, and it was very, very complex when you got into it. Mm-hmm. Now, you ask about Posvar. Now, between Litchfield and Posvar, there was a Jewish, there were several acting chancellors. One of them, Stanton Crawford, literally killed himself taking care of the university. He had a bad heart. Mm-hmm. And he replaced Litchfield, and before long he was dead. Mm-hmm. The other was David
Kurtzman,
David Lawrence's expert on taxation, David Kurtzman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kurtzman was a very sweet and gentle man. He was quite shrewd, but knew, it seemed to me, very little about the governance and the running of universities. Nonetheless, he was a man of such sterling character and so universally admired that his interim chancellorship was quite successful.
Mm-hmm.
I had suggested to Kurtzman that we probe the idea with regard to making David Lawrence chancellor of the university. And I went on to explain why. I said that the chancellor of the university was largely concerned with financial problems.
Mm-hmm.
And it was David Lawrence who had solved the University of Pittsburgh's financial problems by making us state-related.
Mm-hmm.
And that what we really needed was to have this state relationship developed more thoroughly. And also, David Lawrence had splendid relationships with the private sector. Indeed, the Pittsburgh Renaissance was the joint product of his and Richard King Mellon's thinking. And I thought that Lawrence would be the optimal person. Kurtzman then introduced me to Lawrence one time, and Lawrence took me off into the corner and said, "I understand you want me to make me chancellor of the university." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Did you know that I only finished third grade?" I'm not sure that was a fact, but that's what he said. And I said, "So?" And he said, "What do you mean, so?" And I said, "Well, the qualities of a chancellor are different from the qualities of a scholar. Moreover, it seems to me that you have already played the critical role of chancellor. Well, his reaction in the end was that this, his becoming a chancellor of the university would make him a foolish figure because he was so personally ill-qualified. Mm-hmm. I might add parenthetically, because it's a wonderful story, that he commented to me about his regarding his views of governance. He said that when he became the Democratic political boss in Pittsburgh, he told the people in the party that he always wanted to have a Republican district attorney. He said, so the problem of keeping out of jail would not be my problem for my people, but their problem. They had to satisfy a Republican district attorney, and he took the responsibility from me. A point of view which I thought was wonderfully shrewd.
Yeah.
As an individual, Pozvar was much different from both Litchfield and Kurtzman. I've known Wes Pozvar very well in recent years.
Who brought him in?
He was brought in by the chairman of the trustees, whose names I'm forgetting at the moment, and he was sold to the university in a search committee meeting where Adolf Grunbaum, the very distinguished professor of philosophy, questioned him at length about his views on civil liberties. Pozvar is a very remarkable character. He comes from Cleveland, a product of a split family, broken family, went off to West Point, where he did superlatively well. I'm told that he had the highest grade point average in West Point history, even higher than Robert E. Lee's and Douglas MacArthur's, although on record they are the ones that have the highest grade point average. He has told me that he found life at West Point very distasteful, and that his way of asserting himself was to have a very high grade point average. In any event, after he left West Point, he served in the Air Force, flew combat missions, but the big thing in his life was his love for and pursuit of Mildred Miller, a Cleveland girl, slightly older than he, also in his same high school, who had was building a major career as, I believe, a mezzo-soprano in opera houses in Germany. Pozvar got a Rhodes Scholarship and found his years at Oxford very stimulating. Although, as he tells the story, what was stimulating was his need to work very hard while he was at Oxford so he could spend a great deal of time on the continent pursuing Mildred Miller. In any event, they were married. And Pozvar ended up in the Air Force as the founding chairman of the Department of Social Sciences at the Air Force Academy. He took the Pittsburgh appointment, insofar as I understand, because his wife Mildred had become a principal figure at the Metropolitan Opera, which involved a great deal of commuting. And commuting from Colorado Springs was a much heavier job than commuting from Pittsburgh. In any case, he came to Pittsburgh, and he had some very strong ideas about what he wanted to do. He wanted to build up the undergraduate.
About what year was this?
He came, I believe, in 67.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's 67.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to build up the undergraduate, the quality of the undergraduate program. Litchfield was not averse to that happening, but Litchfield was primarily interested in building up the research potential of the university, that is, its graduate and professional schools. Unfortunately for Pozvar, almost immediately upon his arrival, the great radicalism and the student revolt movements of the late 60s and early 70s were upon us. I was, at that time, department chairman of the economics department, and I suppose I was the most strong-willed of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences chairman. I was a hardliner. I was not willing to bend to the student pressures for democratization of the academic process. I had troubles in my own department. Two of my professors, both people I had brought in and for whom I had great personal friendship, became leaders of the revolt. And I not only did my friendships with these people break, but I became rather controversial in my handling of them. In those days, department chairmen had much more power than they do now, and I took the view that if they refused to lecture to their students, they wouldn't get pay increments. They felt that lecturing to students was undemocratic, and I took the view that the teaching process was inherently undemocratic itself, because presumably the professor had more to tell the students than the students had to tell the professors. And that was a view not shared by them or others in their group. Pasvar was, I think, very much in agreement with my view, but had much more political sensitivity than I did. And although I gave him a great deal of what I thought was remarkable advice, what I recall is that he listened patiently to me, then did just the opposite of what I said. It seemed to be, in retrospect, a sure recipe for success. In any event, the issue came to a head on the question of taking academic credit away from the undergraduate ROTC courses. My view was that the Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC, which had been established as a result of the Civil War, was a necessary element in American public life, lest the professional Army officers, those trained at the academies, be the sole leadership in the Army. The faculty, very much influenced by Sam Hayes, a Quaker, conscientious objector in the World War II, and very much opposed to the Vietnam War and any other war, voted to suspend credit for ROTC. I had suggested to Pasvar that he ask the faculty to give him 2 years to increase the academic content of the ROTC program and postpone his judgment until that time. Pasvar seemed to have leapt at the suggestion, but when the time came, he did not make it. He called my home several times, or maybe I think it was maybe two or three, that evening to try to explain why he had not done what he said he would. To this day, I don't know all the pressures on him. I am aware that he had had intelligence to the effect that what ultimately happened at Kent State was originally planned to happen at the University of Pittsburgh. The argument being that this was the part of the country where this revolt should take place, and the further argument was that there would be news people available to record.
Is there any evidence of that remark? That's important.
Well, what is the evidence? The evidence is, did he have this information? I have to take his word that he had it. Did this occur? We know it occurred. Why did it occur at Kent State rather than here? Well, Kent State took a hard line. Pitt waffled. So in one sense, what happened is not inconsistent with this scenario. On the other hand, who knows? The scenario was told me after the event, and I've only gotten it in bits and pieces. In any event, Pasvar's leadership of the university was much more conciliatory after this student-faculty revolt. Pasvar was very, very bitter at the two men in my department who had been the leaders in this revolt. However,
what were their names?
Their names: David Bramhall, B-R-A-M-H-A-L-L, and David Houston, H-O-U-S-T-O-N. Bramhall had come from Hopkins, where his wife and he had been very close personal friends. David Houston had come from Penn State, where he was a splendid teacher. He remained a splendid teacher the rest of his time. Bramhall left the university.
How do you spell Bramhall?
B-R-A-M-H-A-L-L. In any event, I will, I'm to go on. The vice chancellor in charge of the academic departments was a very charismatic person, Charles Peak, P-E-A-K-E. After a certain amount of politicking, the faculty pushed Peak into the provostship. The relationship of Peak and Pazvar was not easy. The chemistry was awkward. Pazvar is a friendly but essentially shy and reserved person. Charles Peak was much less intellectual than Pazvar, but he had an unbelievable instinct for asking the right question. It always amazed me how Peak